the question of the day would seem to be, who is the anonymous donor that enabled the Homeless Angels Group and Mike Carl to purchase the Birkwood Inn? 52 rooms here that will be devoted. It will become the Homeless Angels' new home. The donor that enabled that purchase is remaining anonymous. Homeless Angels bought the motel with that help. 52 rooms here after a number of people were knocked out of a homeless property here, the Magnuson Hotel, and nearly 100 people who were homeless suddenly didn't have any place to go. So this is going to alleviate that situation, but you got to wonder, who is that person? Mike's been a guest on the program a number of times. We'll have him back here soon. I'm Mark Bayshore. Welcome back to Current State here on WKAR. Next Tuesday, Michigan residents will cast a ballot that's filled with choices from the presidency of the United States, the local school boards. There's a lot for voters to consider on November 8th. This election could see historic turnout at the polls, and officials want every voter to make well-informed decisions about their future political leaders. Today, we welcome two guests to talk about the importance of voter education. They both represent the same organization. Beth Moore and Camilla Davis are the co-presidents of the Lansing Area Chapter of the League of Women Voters of Michigan. Beth and Camilla, thank you for being here today.
Welcome.
Let's start with a little history first. When was the League of Women Voters founded? What was its original purpose?
It was founded in 1920, following the passage of the 19th Amendment and women being allowed to vote. It came out of that movement, and it was an effort to educate citizens and get citizens involved in the political process.
And women who had never voted before, informing them. What kind of work does the League do these days? Not just leading up to the election cycle, but around the clock.
Well, we're always busy. We do a lot of voter education. We provide nonpartisan information, especially before an election, with voter guides, both online and in print. And Beth probably will go into those in detail because she's been done our local voter guides. We do education in the schools. We go into classrooms invited by government teachers and put on presentations mm-hmm. about how to vote and why it's important to vote. And then while we're there, we register 18-year-olds or those who will be 18 by election day.
You register people in the schools?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And then we do, of course, the traditional voter registration drives, which we're identified with, but we're finding that a lot of people are registered because of the motor voter work with the Secretary of State's office. So we're always busy and we do a lot.
I understand the last few days you've been training volunteers to be poll watchers for next Tuesday. What does that entail, Beth?
It means they will simply be observers at the polling place. This is something we've done for several or two other elections, and it's part of a national project. And it's the purpose is really for us to learn more about the election process, to identify areas that we can work in the future for educating voters. What are the things that voters aren't understanding when they go to vote? And then really honing in our educational efforts. In the last election, we really noted how many MSU students were confused about where they were to vote. Mm-hmm. And so we really made an effort this year to encourage them to look at their phones and go to the Secretary of State's website or our Vote 411 to find out where they really are registered.
Can't do anything without looking at your phone.
Right? No.
Look at your phones.
Look
it's
at
all,
your phone.
It's all there somewhere.
Right.
Educating these potential voters is really at the core of your mission. Certainly that means staying current on each crop of candidates for a variety of offices. Can you describe for us how the League does that research?
Well, when we determine who's going to be on the ballot, we send them questionnaires asking them to submit information. They all answer the same questions. And this starts at the national level. There are three levels to the league. There's national, state, and local. So the national handles the nationwide elections. State will publish a voter guide that covers the statewide offices. And then we do that at the local level. So every candidate gets a set of questions that they can respond to if they wish, and we publish their responses and into a voter guide so voters can make their own choices.
We're talking about voter education and the importance of making well-informed decisions on Election Day. Beth Moore and Camilla Davis are co-presidents of the Lansing chapter of the League of Women Voters of Michigan. Your research ultimately goes into these voter guides, Beth, which the league publishes for voting districts across the state. Go a little deeper with us. What kinds of information are in the voter guides?
Well, the answers to the questions, as well as general information about getting an absentee ballot and registration deadlines and those kinds of things. The candidates also provide biographical information so that it's a way to for a voter to have some idea of the background on that candidate and what their priorities are. We have gather the information really at all levels in terms of the offices. And so we've gathered information on townships and school board elections, as well as state representatives and other county commissioners and county offices. Not all of that information is available in our printed voter guide. That would be far too many pages, but it is available on the league's website, vote411.org. That website, you put in your address and you get the ballot, the people that you will be voting on for all those offices, those many offices that we vote on in Michigan.
If people want a paper printed voter guide, how do they get one?
Probably the best place is the libraries. We've also gotten them out into other public places, but the library is probably the best place. Libraries are the best place.
Yeah. How do you tailor your messages to different groups? What I mean, do you present your information differently to college students, for example, than seniors or minorities, and so on?
Are you talking in terms of when we do a presentation to?
Yeah, I suppose
not,
so.
Not our voter information is all the same.
Yeah.
You know, that's all. But when we go in to talk to groups, it depends on who we're talking to. When we go into the high schools, we have a PowerPoint that we do that talks about how to vote, why to vote, a little bit of the history of voting. If we're going to do a presentation to an adult group, we might tailor that to the group. I recently did one for a church group, lunch group, and it was tailored to their questions about proposals on the ballot, some statistics about voting, who votes, mm-hmm. how often, just things they were interested in. We went to Burcham Hills Retirement Community and did a presentation on absentee ballots. So, yes, we do tailor it. We ask them what they're interested in knowing.
When you run into an alienated voter or an apathetic voter, do you have a particular message for those people? I mean, do you say, hey, do you vigorously promote the process, or do you engage in some degree of persuasion there, or what?
I try to really help them see how much voting affects their daily lives, that it isn't just voting for president, it's voting for local offices that affect their everyday lives in terms of schools, in terms of the economy, in terms of the environment. I try to find some specific example that might relate to that person. I think that's perhaps the best avenue is seeing how it affects. Somehow people have gotten idea that it doesn't affect me, and it does affect all of us.
Camilla, you referred earlier to the impact of the motor voter law, which means you're automatically registered to vote when you get your driver's license. So that would indicate that we have a very high percentage of eligible voters actually registered.
We do.
But the challenge is turnout. Do you have any recent stats about that trend?
Oh, well, I just saw one recently that said a low 50% voted in the last presidential election. We're hoping for a much better turnout this year. I think the clerks seem to be prepared for a larger turnout.
I think this one is going to be above average, above the mean for sure. We're talking with Camilla Davis and Beth Moore. They are the co-presidents of the Lansing chapter of the League of Women Voters. Now, the League's come into some criticism over the years for not really being nonpartisan, because either it's national organization or state and local organizations, I guess, sometimes do voice support or opposition to particular policies. Is that correct?
Yes, the league has two arms. The voter service is what we're best known for, probably, but we also take stands on issues, but only after careful member study and consensus on an issue. So we develop a position on a particular issue. It's sometimes those particular positions that people may disagree with and then label in certain ways.
Do you try to have a firewall between the policy side and between the voter education?
Yes.
I imagine you try to separate those two, much like a newspaper separates the editorial page from its
That's
reporting.
Very
okay.
Good.
I mean, under the umbrella of the League of Women Voters, it takes positions, but still calls itself nonpartisan. Does that ever bother you? How do you respond to people who say you shouldn't call yourselves nonpartisan if you've got a policy wing taking particular positions?
Well, when there's a ballot proposal at the state level, we study it and we decide if it fits in with something that we have, what we call positions, that our league stances on certain issues. And we decide how it fits in with those. And we'll decide whether we're going to take a stance on that, either for or against. But we don't do that on every single policy or every single, ballot proposal. Mm-hmm. Now, there are local ballot proposals that we don't. We could take a stance on if it fit with our positions, but we don't choose to do that on any right now, because there are quite a few ballot proposals locally. But we don't follow any party. We never support or oppose any candidate. And if some issue, ballot proposal, happens to fall in with some candidate's policies or program, we'll still take a position on the proposal. But when we publish our voter guides, they will publish pro and con.
And that is kind of that's the equivalent of the reporting in the newspaper as opposed to the editorial page in the newspaper. I got it. Okay. Back in 2013, Michigan passed a series of campaign finance and disclosure laws that affect so-called issue ads. And the laws said that the ads didn't have to specifically disclose the name of a campaign donor, but instead include a disclaimer that says this ad was authorized by fill in the blank. Do you have any thoughts about how that messaging affects voters? Does the league actively push against those kinds of ads?
The league has positions favoring full disclosure of who is funding an ad, and we have strong feelings about lessening the impact of money on our political system. We're concerned about the way ads are now with people not being able to know who's funding them.
What is the website here that people can go to avail themselves of what you're about and any information?
Well, we do have a local league website, and probably the easiest way to get there, because it has a very unusual address, is just to Google League of Women Voters Lansing area.
Okay.
And that has a lot of background information on the local league. We do want to stress that we are labeled League of Women Voters of League of Women Voters, but men are welcome. And so we do have quite a number of male members. And also, league membership is open to anyone 16 or older. So we are encouraging young people to get involved. Hmm. If information on the state league, it's League of Women Voters of Michigan, and they have a very nice website. And then League of Women Voters, LWV.org, would take you to the national. So there's lots of ways to learn about what the league does.
And your poll watchers won't be stopping people from taking ballot selfies next Tuesday.
Actually, poll watchers just observe.
Understood. Yeah. Understood. We've been talking about voter education efforts and making informed choices at the polls on Election Day this coming Tuesday. Beth Moore and Camilla Davis are co-presidents of the Lansing chapter of the League of Women Voters of Michigan. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Coming up on Current State, Neighbors in Action. We'll speak with a Capital Area Literacy Coalition known as the Reading People about the progress they've been making helping kids and adults in the greater Lansing area learn to read and write. That's coming up on Current State. Current State on WKAR, thank you for joining us today. About a month ago, a group of guys from Michigan went to Tennessee for a few days. The reason for the trip was a bachelor party of four-wheeling fun. The trip took a turn over breakfast one morning when a dog appeared at their cabin. She was really hungry, so they fed her, and ultimately the group figured out that the dog was struggling with a litter of puppies out in the wilderness. What happened next has brought news media attention all over America and now here to WKAR. Each of the guys adopted one of the puppies, and the pup's mother also has found a home here in Michigan. Joining us by phone to talk about this heartwarming story, Dave Perkins. Dave's one of the groomsmen from this group of friends. His puppy is named Daisy. Welcome to Current State, Dave.
Hey, Mark. How you doing?
Just great. Several days of riding around on four-wheel vehicles in Tennessee. This is a group of guys who probably know each other well, and this turned out so differently. Tell us about the first time you laid eyes on the one dog when she appeared at your cabin.
Yeah, we were cooking some breakfast the first morning we were down there, and we had some bacon going on the griddle, and they were getting pretty smoky in the cabin there, so we opened up the doors and let it air out and let smoke out. And we were out there walking around outside, and this dog turned up, and she'd sit right down. There's like a mat right in front of the cabin there, and she sat right down on it, you know, and she wouldn't. She just looked in the cabin. She wouldn't come in, and so we were eating breakfast there and left the door open, you know, and she just sat there watching us, and you could tell she was really well behaved. You know, she knew she wasn't supposed to come in unless she was told she could come in. And we finished our breakfast there, and we had some leftovers, so we went out there and we started feeding her, you know, some table scraps we had. You could tell she'd wolf them right down. She was really hungry, and we got her some water too. And as soon as you put water down in front of her, she'd just gobble it right up.
Yeah. You started calling her Annie, as in little orphan. Take us from meeting Annie to figuring out that she was actually trying to care for puppies.
Yeah, it took a little bit before we figured out that she had some puppies. We were, I think it was that evening, we were sitting around the fire, you know, after a long day of riding, and she'd get real protective of an area back behind the cabin. There was a road that came around there, and out in the woods, anytime she heard a noise or anything, she'd take right off. over to that area, and she kept going over to that area. And the next morning, we're like, well, you know, go check it out, and started putting two and two together. And we got over there, you could hear your puppies yipping over there.
How? What kind of shape were the puppies in?
They were surprisingly in pretty good shape, like healthy wise. But they were, you know, they'd been living in a hole for a little while, so they were covered in fleas and dirt and everything else.
Mm.
And Annie had just been giving them everything she had. We found, you know, boxes of food and stuff she drug over to this hole, old pizza boxes and stuff like that.
How did the idea take shape for you guys to actually adopt these puppies?
We kind of started figuring that out once we found, you know, they were out in the wild and they needed to be rescued. So once we got them out of the holes there and got them up to the cabin, we kind of started talking about it, and we decided, you know, we needed to bring these pups and the mom home.
Was there a point at which all of the brood was in the cabin with you guys?
Yeah, we had a full place there with all of them. Yeah. You know?
And how many altogether are we talking here, Dave?
There's eight of them total.
Oh my gosh!
There's the mom and then seven pups. So, you know.
I assume you'd driven to Tennessee, so you weren't trying to bring the puppies home on an airplane or anything.
No, we trailered all of our off-road toys down there. So we had three vehicles we took down there, and then the groom's dad and one of the close friends there, they ended up. They had the dogs in one truck, so we had to stop quite a few times for potty breaks for all of them and let them run around.
It was a record-setting number of rest stop breaks. Is that it?
Oh yeah. There was numerous stops. You know, it took a lot longer to get back home than it did coming down there.
Did you hesitate? Did you hesitate at all? I mean, it would appear that this poor dog and the puppies were abandoned, I take it. Did you hesitate at all about just taking them home?
No. Once we were down there, I think the total length of the trip, we were down there for like 5 days, and we kind of, you know, checked around the area. But you could definitely tell, you know, she'd been abandoned and that she needed a home.
Yeah. We're talking with Dave Perkins, one of the Michigan men who recently discovered and adopted a dog and all of her puppies that they had discovered while at a bachelor party trip to Tennessee. I'm curious to learn about the groom, Mitch Craddock. How did he specifically react to all of this happening during his bachelor party?
He took it pretty well. I mean, we were, you know, we planned on doing a lot of riding, and we kind of had to call a little bit of an audible and do some caring for the puppies. So he took it pretty well. He was pretty excited along with the rest of us.
How did your wives and significant others respond to, you know, the bringing a puppy back home? Any resistance?
They were all pretty well with it. I don't have one of those yet, so that was a pretty easy decision for me that I was going to take on. So.
What was the story? A big hit at the wedding itself? Did it make the rounds?
Yeah. There was quite a few people talking about it. Yeah, it was definitely, you know, a bachelor party to remember for sure.
What breeds are these puppies?
We don't know exactly. That's they're kind of we nicknamed them the Tennessee Mutt puppies because they're kind of a mixture of a little bit of everything. Some of them kind of look like they got some lab in them, and some of them got like a little bit of retriever, so kind of a mix of a little bit of everything.
Are any of you and your friends already dog owners?
Mitch, the groom, they've got a chocolate lab that I believe she's a couple years, she might be a year old now, and so they've got two, and then two total, and a good buddy Jake there on the groom or on the bachelor party there, they've got a total of three dogs. So yeah, some of the people that took them there, they had more than one dog at the house. So
tell us about your puppy, Daisy, a female, I take it.
Yep. She's a ball of fire. She's got a lot of energy. So we always got to make sure we get her outside and run it off every day.
You referred to the Tennessee Mutt Puppies, and this is the this is also the name of the Facebook page that your group has started. When we first found your page yesterday, it had about 600 members, and that number shot up by almost another 300 just as of this morning. MLive did a big story. NPR was on this story. Why do you think this story's grabbed people the way it has?
I think it's a good feel-good story. You know, I feel like we did a good thing, and a lot of people, you know, realize that. And, a lot of people feel good about it.
Some people friending your Facebook page are from other countries. I mean, it really has gone viral or close to it.
It's made it across the pond. It's pretty amazing. We're very humbled by it.
Here's a question for dog lovers who are hearing about this story. Do you guys need anything for these puppies?
I think everyone's pretty well set. We're trying to do something, you know, maybe like the pet adoptions and stuff. We're trying to encourage people, you know, to check out the pet adoptions and just donate to your local shelters.
We've been talking with Dave Perkins. Dave's one of the Michigan men who went to Tennessee a few weeks ago for a bachelor party and came back with a puppy. Dave Perkins, thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks for having me on.
And coming up on Current State, information technology insiders say the Lansing area has plenty of IT jobs that need filling. Plenty, as in hundreds. We'll talk about that with one of those IT insiders coming up on Current State. Former state representative and Senator Earl Nelson has died after a brief illness. Nelson's also remembered in Lansing for performing the Earl Nelson Singers, which recently honored him at a 50th anniversary celebration, along with his service in the legislature. The one-time Lansing teacher served as director of the Office of Equity for the State Department of Education. Mr. Nelson had been living in Florida recently. 6 days before a presidential election, there's still probably one thing Americans can agree on, that the ability to read and write is of paramount importance. Still, according to the 2012 census survey, 20% of adults in the greater Lansing area are functionally illiterate. For Neighbors in Action today, we're checking back in with the Capital Area Literacy Coalition, sometimes referred to as the Reading People. They help children and adults learn to read, write, and speak English with the ultimate goal of helping individuals achieve self-sufficiency. To get an update on what the organization's been up to, we're joined now in the studio by board member and longtime volunteer, John Lesk. Welcome back, John.
Thank you, Mark. It's good to be here.
A long list of programs kind of fall under the umbrella of the Capital Area Literacy Coalition. Let's touch on each one of them here briefly. The Read to Succeed program. What is that? How does that work?
Yeah, that's the probably the most successful way to get anyone to read better and write better is one-on-one tutor-student interaction. And what we do is we provide that for 10 different schools in the Lansing School District. The teachers are doing a yeoman's work.
Mm-hmm. You're in some new schools, I guess, since you were here last.
Yeah, we've got a total of 10. That's right, and we have we leverage volunteers there with their one-on-one tutoring, mostly in the afternoon, but one school's in the morning, and we bring the lower elementary school students' scores up to the third grade reading level in almost every case.
Okay, are you? Always seeking out more schools to participate in this program?
We are invited in by the faculty and the parents, and it's a contract with the students' parents and the faculty there.
Family literacy is also a focus of some of your efforts. What happens there?
Well, we go into the projects here in the area, and we key out some teams in there, and we hire them. We train them and hire them to go back in and teach some courses there during the afternoon time, early evening time. And that keeps a lot of literacy going there in that area. And it keeps young minds occupied where they otherwise wouldn't be.
Right. Who becomes members of these teams? How does that tend to work out?
Well, we seek out volunteers, and then we vet them very completely and train them very well. And it's the folks usually in that neighborhood, although I've done it a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
They're helped out.
English language learning and citizenship. What happens there?
ESL, English as a second language, is a key to citizenship, and especially for the migrant surge that we have mm-hmm. recently. I've taught a 43-year-old Eritrean mother of six how to read and write, and that was something to see her eyes light up. And these are not people that are dumb by any means. They're smart. In many cases, they can speak five or six different languages, just not English.
Tell us about the MSU Literacy Corps.
The MSU Literacy Corps is a wonderful outreach program where we leverage the talents here at MSU, both from the students, and students are able to earn credits and volunteer and get credits for further efforts, many of the cases in the Read to Succeed program.
How long have you been a volunteer, Dave?
Gosh.
Don.
Since 2005. Yeah.
And it sounds like your experience with the Eritrean woman was particularly memorable. You feel like you were the linchpin. You were the factor that enabled her to really become literate in
absolutely.
English.
She's taking classes now at Lansing Community College, and many of our students, instead of holding one or two jobs, three jobs under the table, they go on to work one job, full-time job, and pay taxes where they're before they weren't.
Mm. The last time you were here, you told us about serving in Afghanistan when you were in the Army, and you did some English teaching and tutoring when you were there. Talk to us a little bit more about the relationship that develops between a teacher and a student when they can't speak each other's language.
Well, first, it's got to be built on a bond of trust. And at first, there's no trust there. But once you get into it and you start building that bond of trust, it opens up a floodgate and a whole nother world for both parties, as well as the student and the tutor.
I'm speaking with John Lesk, retired colonel, who serves as a board member and a volunteer with the Capital Area Literacy Coalition, also known as the Reading People, here on Neighbors in Action on WKAR's Current State. How can you tutor or teach English as a second language if you don't know the language of the person that you're teaching?
Oh, a wonderful story. You know, we have wonderful instructors, and we have wonderful techniques developed by Lois Bader and the Bader system on how to do that. I got to emphasize, I can't emphasize it enough, that you do not need to know the language. And if they can teach a knuckle-dragging grunt like me how to teach people how to read and write English as a second language, they can teach anybody. And it's just two extra nights out of the month. We have our next session on the 15th and 16th of November. And the ESL, that's our basic literacy tutor tutorial. And then 29 and 30 November is our ESL lab.
How have you become so enthusiastic about this work? I mean, you alluded to the sparkle in the eye of the Eritrean woman you worked with. Talk to us about how you became so enthusiastic about this particular activity.
Well, it's simple logic. When you have 93,000, according to the data that you you put out earlier at the opening of this session, in the Tri-County area of people that can't read. That's indicative of a large poverty population in poverty. And in fact, you can just about look at a neighborhood or and the actuaries are doing this, insurance actuaries are doing this, figuring out where people can't read. And then our insurances are more, our health care costs go up, our costs to our criminal justice system go up when people can't read. 80% of our juvenile kids with problems in our justice system now can't read. 75% of our incarcerated prisoners in our prison system now can't read a prescription on a medicine bottle, can't make a hot pocket in a microwave. Mm-hmm. So I mean that's a problem that costs society dearly, and teaching someone to read and write is the first step in breaking that cycle of poverty.
What have you learned about what causes adult illiteracy? How does that unfold in the 21st century here?
It's amazing, but it starts with poverty. And we have people out there that can't read in poverty, and they're having children that can't read in poverty. We can't fathom, those of us that have grown up around books, can't fathom a house without books. And the new faces of our illiterate society now is someone that owns a computer, someone that owns an iPhone, someone that owns an iPad, and can't read.
Are you in need of volunteers right now?
Absolutely. We are in dire need of ESL instructors, I'll tell you right now.
Really?
Because of the current situation.
What particular skill set would you say enables a volunteer like you to be really good at this?
Someone with an open mind, someone that is able to make a connection or wants to make a connection with people and to grow as a human being themselves.
I understand you're coming up on your annual appeal for donations. How can people help?
Well, you can access that on our website at readingpeople.org, readingpeople.org. Also, you can call our headquarters there at 485-4949 and like us on Facebook. And I've got and it's tax deductible. We're a 501c3 organization. And we have a wonderful fundraiser at the Potter House on the 30th of November, where we'll have Sergei Kvitko reciting Babar, the magic elephant.
Very good. That's at the Potter House. We want to thank retired Colonel John Lesk, a board member and volunteer with the Capital Area Literacy Coalition, also known as the Reading People. John, continued success. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me again.
Current State is looking for more nominations for our Neighbors in Action feature. Help us out. Email us your suggestions to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line or tweet us at KAR Current State and tell us a little bit about why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. State on 90.5 WKAR. We come your way three times every weekday, 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. on 90.5 every day at noon on AM 870, and we're all over WKAR.org. Hundreds of IT jobs are available in mid-Michigan. That's a line from a column in last Sunday's Lansing State Journal. Our next guest collaborated on that column with an executive of Capital Area Michigan Works, the organization that helps job seekers. Both claim that a number of persistent myths keep people from pursuing jobs or getting training in the IT field, which they say offers plenty of job opportunities here in the Lansing area. To explain, we welcome Andrea Reagan, the collaborator. Andrea is the executive director of the Capital Area IT Council. Good to see you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Been a while. We've worked on stories a few times here over the years at WKAR. In the column that you and Edie Hatter-Williams collaborated on, you lay out five myths about the IT sector. Now, but before we talk about each one of those, I take it it's because of these myths that so many jobs go unfilled?
I think it's each of these myths is a factor. It's a complicated sort of layers of reasoning why there are so many available positions in IT and why the demand is increasing. But while the demand for IT careers is increasing, the supply is not increasing accordingly. And so these myths really address some of the factors as to why that might be the case.
Sure.
So in trying to coordinate the workforce development options that we have for job seekers and for education institutions, we want to make sure that that fits the open market. So that's where we want to break down some of these myths and make sure that people are choosing IT careers and choosing IT education to help with the increasing demand.
The column actually alludes to a sixth myth. Let's get that one out of the way first, namely that there aren't any jobs in IT. Your data contradicts that. What data do you look at, and what is it showing here in 2016?
Certainly. We look at a lot of data, and there's different ways to compartmentalize IT careers. One of the ways that we look at that is looking at any career that fits the code for science, technology, engineering, and math. And actually, the direction that these IT careers are going, we're going to expand that into what we are now calling STEAM, which is science, technology, engineering, arts and math.
Yeah.
Because we need the creative thinkers. We need innovators. And so IT careers that fit that STEAM realm are increasing, and they're anticipated to grow at least 12% by 2020. Mm. So it's just continually going up.
Well, let's run through the five myths here, and I'll have you comment briefly on each one. The first one is young people already know technology. I kind of get that. I know what people are thinking when they say that. What does that mean, though?
Well, I have had actual interactions when I go to try to promote the growth of IT careers and the lucrative nature of IT careers and how they promote lifelong learning at education institutions, where I end up interacting with both students and parents, either at the K-12 level or even community college or university level. And I have had direct interactions with parents that say, but the kids already know technology.
Mm-hmm.
And I try not to be rude as I make a parallel statement and say, well, I filed my own taxes this year. Does that make me a certified tax consultant? It doesn't, and I understand where they're coming from and how it might seem that way from the outside. But what that actually means is that parent has just made my point for me in articulating that we have more end users of technology than ever because their children have devices, often multiple devices. They know how to use them, but they're not coding them or writing the apps or building the network and hardware that support this device usage.
Right.
So the more that technology permeates every aspect of our lives, the more end users we have, which means we need to backfill those positions to continue the support for technology development.
The another myth, IT jobs are short-lived.
I think this myth comes directly from, again, talking about sort of that parent audience of current students. And they lived through an era where AOL and other .com positions came and went. Only 40% of .com positions that were created in the mid-90s survived past the year 2000. And so that was a pretty huge drop. But this is not simply web development that we're talking about. We're talking about technology that permeates every aspect of our lives, and it's the industry that permeates all other industries, which might actually be speaking ahead to some of these other myths. But technology is in every aspect of our lives, which means it's in every aspect of careers. Technology is in healthcare. Technology is in manufacturing. Technology is in supply chain. Technology is in finance and insurance. So each one of these types of organizations and each one of these industries has increasing demand, which means that these jobs are stable. As the demand continues to increase, the salaries are going to get higher. The recruitment efforts are going to continue to increase accordingly. And the people that can fill these careers are very, very valuable. So these are stable, lucrative careers.
Andrea Reagan's our guest. Andrea is the executive director of the Capital Area IT Council. We're talking about the hundreds of IT jobs that are available here in mid-Michigan. And we're exploring that by addressing a number of what Andrea says are myths about the IT sector. The myth number three, a computer science degree and 3 to 5 years of experience are needed.
Well, and you will see that listed as quote unquote required or recommended in many of the job postings, which is where we're getting our data and our information on how many jobs are open and where are they being posted. When we scrape that information and that data, that's certainly listed as a desire from these employers, but it's a desire. There is a severe talent constraint across multiple industries with wanting someone with that bachelor's degree in computer science, some experience under their belt, and ready to come in mid-stride, mid-level in their career. Those people that are there are typically gainfully employed and not necessarily as mobile as employers might want to see. And like I mentioned, we don't have as many people feeding into those career tracks and those education tracks as there is in the demand for the market. So even though that's what you might see in postings, I just encourage every job seeker, or even if you're not a job seeker, even if you have another career or job altogether, anyone interested in technology, apply. Explore those options, apply, apply, apply. And that's because with the interaction we have with employers at Capital Area Michigan Works and through the Capital Area IT Council, the number one thing I hear from employers isn't just where are the degrees, it's how do we support education, but also, Andrea, where are the good people? Where are the good people? Where are the passionate people? Mm. Where's someone I can sit down in an interview and say, what kind of network do you have at home? What do you like to build? Mm. And really understanding that passion and that interest and that access to technology is so much more important than having the exact requirements that are listed in any job posting. And I don't think that's true just for IT. I think that that goes across the board for job seekers and employers trying to make a match of the skills that they want and the skills that they have. Apply anyway. Don't hesitate.
Enthusiasm matters.
Enthusiasm matters. And it matters a lot.
Myth number four, you'll learn everything you need to know in school.
I think anyone who at any level of education with a little bit of career experience under their belt can say that's just not true. And I think that's especially not true in IT because it's the fastest growing but also the fastest changing industry on the market. IT and education and careers in IT come with the expectation of lifelong learning because technology is always changing. So mostly what employers are looking for and what job seekers need to know is, did you learn how to learn? And if you did and you can apply that lifelong learning aspect or be hungry or be an innovator, any room for creativity or outside the box thinking, there's a lot of room for that in IT careers.
Here is and myth number five. I'm sure you take great pleasure in dispelling this. You must leave the area to get a good paying IT job.
Absolutely. I want to bust that myth to the ground because that is just not true.
Well, we have hundreds of jobs in our area.
Hundreds.
You're saying you monitor this every quarter?
Mm-hmm.
Is
quarterly,
that right?
Yep. And sometimes up to every 90 days. And in any 90-day period that we do a scrape on the internet for job postings that fit either that STEM or STEAM mold, I find anywhere from 500 to 900 positions available. And that might be conservative because not everybody's posting every position online. Sometimes they're taking different recruiting efforts. But there are hundreds of positions available.
You've made it clear that IT jobs are apt to end up in any number of different kinds of sectors. Can you generalize at all about our area, about the Lansing area, about where these jobs are? Are they
I mean,
we hear all the time about the future being in healthcare.
Right. I will say that Lansing
is that one.
I mean, the capital area, the Tri-County area around Mid-Michigan, we have a booming local business community and local economy that's not always recognized on the statewide level the same way that some of our partners are across the business belt in Grand Rapids or the Detroit area. But Lansing thriving in each of these industries in healthcare, in the return of manufacturing, and in insurance and finance, which I would say are three of our major players, that creates a wealth of opportunities within IT. And we really have, we don't have the critical mass of job seekers yet to fill those, and there are diverse opportunities. So I encourage anyone, if you have a different career and you're thinking about a transition into IT, how would that apply? If you worked in the medical field, do you want to get into electronic medical records or coding? You know, have you worked in manufacturing and do you want to explore more about robotics? Have you worked in insurance and finance and you simply want to make this more applicable to your industry? There are diverse opportunities and they really are across the board.
I want to close with a more challenging question here. You do allude on, I think Capital Area Michigan Works and maybe the IT Council as well, allude to a lack of success in strategic education programs. What isn't happening in education that ought to be happening?
That is a difficult question to answer. And that comes back to some of the myths we already discussed. Is the biggest challenge and the biggest lack of success that we see is simply students of all levels, K-12, community college, university, not choosing IT careers, which is why I have a job. I could promote them all day for every factor of not just how valuable they are, but how much these employers that I'm working with and speaking to have a sense of the value of human capital. They need the passion, they need the personalities, and they want it to be something that job seekers choose. So look at those careers, look at the pathways. They're wide open with possibility. And I would say that's where we want to see an increased influence and increased success in education and training.
Really interesting discussion. We want to thank our guest, Andrea Reagan. Andrea is Executive Director of the Capital Area IT Council. Thank you, Andrea.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our show for today. Coming up Thursday on Current State, we've talked to many Michiganders about who they'd vote for in the upcoming presidential election, but what about those people engulfed in the criminal justice system? We speak to a former inmate about her choice for president and ask a man still in prison if he could vote, who would he choose? Also, there's an area of Yellowstone National Park known as the Zone of Death because, due to a constitutional loophole, it's been pointed out that a crime committed there could legally go unpunished. We'll talk to the man who first published a paper about this loophole more than 10 years ago and is still trying to get Congress to change it. That's MSU law professor Brian Cault. That and more tomorrow on Current State. Peter Wharf is our executive producer. Katie Cook directed the show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and Drew Hill. You can stay connected with Current State on Twitter, at KAR Current State, and on Facebook, we're at Current State from WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. We hope to see you tomorrow on Current State, here on WKAR.